Production support for Earth Eats comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers. On Bloomington's east side, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview. Brunch every Sunday from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. NeedMoreRoasters.com. And Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeigner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm Kate Young. This week on our show, tacos. We visit with the owner and chef of Sasan Mexican Cuisine. You'll find them on Saturdays in Bloomington at the Winter Farmers Market with their Yucatan-style tacos. We'll talk about how they make the carnitas and what to look forward to in their menu for the summer market starting in April. We've got a story from Harvest Public Media about new challenges for Black farmers. All just ahead, so stay tuned. A lot going on in food news lately. Alex Chambers, what jumped out for our news team?
Hi, Kate. Well, first we've got tariffs. Later, we've got organic eggs. And as we seem to almost every week these days, we've got controversy over SNAP. Foreign countries are likely to target commodity crops, peanut butter, even Florida orange juice, in retaliation for proposed taxes on imported steel and aluminum. Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach explains why it might be a positive thing for consumers.
Now that President Trump has imposed the tariffs, canned goods might cost a bit more, but juice, peanut butter, and corn and soybeans fed to hogs and chickens could be discounted. Wes Peterson is an agricultural economist at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He says if you cut off demand from some of America's biggest trade customers, you'll end up with too much supply.
And that means that they're buying less, and that means that we have more left in the United States, and all things equal, prices will go down.
Peterson also says when consumers get a better deal on food, it comes at the expense of farmers because a surplus will push down crop prices. Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue says retaliation is a concern, but tariffs put the U.S. in a stronger bargaining position in talks over trade deals like NAFTA. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Disagreement over the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program once again threatens to stall progress on the Farm Bill. Lawmakers are trying to hammer out a compromise on work requirements for SNAP recipients. Currently, able-bodied adults without dependents from ages 18 to 49 can only receive SNAP benefits for 3 months unless they work or sign up for a training program. The proposal would extend work requirements until age 65. States would decide who gets exemptions. House Agriculture Chairman Mike Conaway, a driving force behind the proposal, told Politico that he was defending cuts to SNAP and the proposal would not shrink benefits. He insisted that not one person would be forced off SNAP due to the proposed work or training requirements. Meanwhile, health advocates are squaring off against anti-hunger groups after a task force recommended cutting sugary drinks from the list of approved SNAP purchases. A report last year from the USDA found that sugary drinks made up 5.5% of the grocery budget of SNAP recipients, more than any other food category. By comparison, non-SNAP households spend about 4% of their grocery shopping on soft drinks. The USDA concluded it wasn't a problem. There were no major differences, they said, in the spending habits of SNAP and non-SNAP households. But in a New York Times article, nutrition professor Marion Nessel called those findings shocking. She told the Times, SNAP is a multi-billion dollar taxpayer subsidy of the soda industry. The anti-hunger group Food and Research Action Center pushed back against the recommendation to cut soda, warning it could limit SNAP's effectiveness by stigmatizing beneficiaries and throwing sand in the gears of this very successful program. According to a study from the University of Maryland last year, about 70% of Americans favor banning soda and candy from SNAP purchases. The USDA has tossed out a set of proposed changes for raising certified organic chickens and livestock. Harvest Public Media's Esther Honig reports that small organic farmers consider themselves on the losing end.
The proposed Obama-era rules required organic farms to give animals more space and access to the outdoors. But the U.S. Department of Agriculture now says it doesn't have the authority to enforce those changes, which were supposed to start in May. With the reversal, small organic farmers say larger operations will only have to provide the minimum amount of space. Francis Thickey runs an organic dairy in Iowa and is a former member of the National Organic Standards Board.
It's very unfair, I think, for the small to mid-sized dairy farmers who are meeting the letter and the spirit of the law are being forced out of the market.
Large organic egg producer Calmain Foods said during the 2016 public comment period that the rules would have caused economic issues. The USDA says the rules would have meant fewer and pricier organic eggs. Esther Honig, Harvest Public Media.
Our thanks to Chad Bouchard and Harvest Public Media for those reports.
And our thanks to you, Alex Chambers.
No problem, Kate.
The population of farmers in the United States is growing older, and it's more pronounced in the black farming community. The Trump administration has proposed to strip funding in the coming Farm Bill for a program that helps minority and veteran farmers. And as Aaron McKinstry reports for Harvest Public Media, losing that money could make things particularly tough for black farmers.
Cedric Rowe is driving down a gravel road between rows and rows of perfectly spaced pecan trees. He works at an 800-acre farm at Cypress Pond, which is a former plantation in southwest Georgia.
This is our old grove. These trees are over 100 years old, the big ones that you see.
There's an orange grove flanked by patches of longleaf pine. There's a vineyard and a patch of giant collards. Rowe runs out to the field to pick one.
I needed something that I can be more outdoors and run free. It was kind of in my blood, I say, you know, as far as farming.
He's a young black farmer, inspired by his grandmother and aunts who farmed a small plot of land. Only 1.4% of American farmers are black, and most of them live in the South, where the connection to the land began under the duress of slavery and later sharecropping.
Coming from where I'm from, you don't really find too many people with opportunity to be able to work in a field like this. Let alone, you know, history of our people, we're used to being in the field, but at the same time as technology grew, we didn't grow with it.
In the 1920s, 14% of farmers were black, but many left farming because of the painful history of slavery and the Great Migration to industrial cities in the North. Those who stayed faced discrimination from lending institutions, including the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And as technology advanced and the average size of the farm grew, many black farmers didn't have access like white farmers to loans that would modernize their operations. But then in 1999, black farmers won a class action lawsuit known as the Pigford case against the USDA for past discrimination. Since then, more than $2 billion has gone to black farmers and their descendants. National Black Farmers Association President John Boyd was part of that lawsuit. His nonprofit and others believe that one of the keys to helping young black farmers today is the 2501 program, which is part of the Farm Bill and provides special funding for training and outreach to minority farmers.
Any type of cuts to a program like that really, really would hurt, especially black farmers.
Funding to the program was cut in half in the 2014 Farm Bill, and the pool of eligible participants was expanded to include veterans. Congress will debate it again this year.
I'm worried overall about this administration and the lack of inclusiveness, the lack of communication.
Shirley Sherrod has spent her career fighting the loss of black-owned land. She co-founded the nonprofit New Communities, which in 1985 lost the largest tract of black-owned land in the country after a drought and federal refusal to help until it was too late. After the Pigford settlement, New Communities purchased Cypress Pond with the intent to provide training, equipment, and guidance, particularly to help the next generation of young black farmers.
We want to train young farmers, especially African-American farmers, because that's a dying breed right now.
That's where Rowe comes in. He says, unlike his peers, he found a job in his field right after college and wants to show other young people that farming has changed in the last few decades.
With our generation, they get the wrong perception of farming. If you actually get them out here and show them, then they'll see a difference in it.
And that's what Boyd's been working toward, too.
Owning your own land is very positive tool, and growing food is a positive tool as well. It's not something bad or you should be ashamed of. So I'm really trying to rechange the thinking of African Americans across the country.
He farms over 400 acres in Virginia, continuing the legacy that he inherited from his dad and grandfather, a legacy he hopes to pass on to his children. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Mary McKinstry.
Support for Harvest Public Media comes from this station and from the Center for Great Plains Studies at the University of Nebraska, host of April's Conservation and Tourism Conference, Plain Safaris, in Kearney, Nebraska. Learn how tourism can save our natural environment and help communities grow. More at go.unl.edu/tourism.
There's more where that came from at harvestpublicmedia.org. Production support comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. When I say the word taco, a specific image probably comes to mind. And I wouldn't be surprised if that image is different for each of us. It might be a crispy corn shell filled with spicy ground beef, cheese, and shredded lettuce. Or maybe it's a soft taco, a flour tortilla with beans, cheese, and red salsa. While most of us know what a taco is, the variations on the taco theme are endless. I think we can all agree that the basic structure of a taco would be some kind of filling folded inside of a tortilla. The taco has its origins in Mexico, and each region in Mexico has its own type of taco. Along the Pacific coast, you'll find tacos featuring fish and seafood. In the northern Mexican states, you might find tacos made with flour tortillas, filled with barbecued or even dried meats. And in Mexico City, you can find tacos from all regions of the country. Our guest today was born in Mexico City, but moved with his family to the Yucatan as a young teenager. Today, he brings a distinctly Yucatan-style cuisine to his taco stand in Bloomington, Indiana.
My name is Jesus Barajas. I'm the owner of a little food stand that we have here at the Bloomington Winter Farmers Market. The name of the booth is Sazon, Mexican cuisine, and we offer tacos with different toppings and sauces for people to enjoy.
We have a mild and a hot habanero sauce, and then a mild green tomatillo sauce.
Yeah, I'm preparing a pork carnitas taco for a customer. We usually just heat up a couple of tortillas and the little grill that we have here for a couple of minutes. And then when it's ready, we transfer it to the boat that we use. We have our carnitas ready in a little crock pot warmer. We put a generous amount of our carnitas pork into the warmed up tortilla. We just give it to the customer so they can add any toppings that you like. We have different toppings here. We have chopped cilantro, pickled red onions, fresh raw onions,
radishes, cucumbers, limes, and we offer two sauces. One is mild tomatillo, and the other one is really spicy but really delicious habanero sauce. For the pork carnitas, we usually recommend the pickled red onions that we prepare ourselves, maybe some cilantro, a little cucumbers, lime, and if you combine both of the sauces, it's really good because it balances from one to another, so it's not that spicy, but you still get the flavor of the habanero and a lot of citrus that goes in there.
I met Jesus and his wife, Maria, at the bustling winter farmer's market. I met later with Jesus in a quieter space to learn more about his business.
It's a family business, and it's my wife, Maria, and myself. We've been doing this. This is going to be our third year on the Saturday market. And I have a boy named Leonardo. He's 9, and he helps us as well on the market on Saturdays.
Of all the toppings Cezanne offers for their tacos, the pickled onions are the most striking. They're almost hot pink in color with an equally bright flavor. I had to know how they're made.
They're really simple. We start with red onions. We use red wine vinegar as well. We kind of bring to a simmer a little the red wine vinegar with a little bit of water, like equal parts, a little bit of sugar, salt. And we bring that to a simmer, and we pour it over the sliced onions, and we let it sit for overnight. Usually, it's enough for them to be the right consistency.
The pickled onions are an important element in the traditional taco from the Yucatan.
The dish that we have at the Saturday market on the summer, it's called cochinita pibil. It's from the Yucatan. The name that we put on the farmer's market is like Yucatan braised pork. And that's the type of those pickled onions, that's like the traditional way to eat that kind of meat or a taco or a sandwich in the Yucatan. And that's why we come up with that idea. And also like that bright color that we have is because of the red wine vinegar that we use. We try to use like a good quality vinegar, and that helps a lot too. The pork taco that we usually have, the chorizo and egg that we have, they're really traditional. The type of food that we used to eat when we were living in Yucatan. On the vegan option, we play a little bit more with that. Like we work with the season, and that's not as traditional, but we try to use whatever is in season, whatever vegetable is in season, and use like the spices or the sauces just to give that touch. We use a lot of, on the pork, and also like sometimes with the vegan, we use annatto seeds. That then becomes a chiote paste. That's another name for it, like really red and bright. You grind a lot of spices with it, with those seeds, and you add like different kinds of pepper and garlic and onion, and like you make a paste at the end with it, and then you marinate. Either you can do it traditionally, it's the meat, the pork, and but we use that for the vegetables as well, to give it that flavor and that authenticity, even though it's not very authentic to find vegan tacos, right? I mean, right now it is more, it's becoming more available for people that is vegetarian or vegan, but traditionally it's mostly meats in Mexico.
Like most of the booths at the winter farmer's market, Cezanne's space is tight and limited. During the main market season, which runs April through November, Cezanne works from a tent with more space and an expanded menu. I wanted to know what else they offered at their outdoor market stand.
We do the three tacos. We also do drinks. We've been doing drinks since we started. So we do horchata, that one that we make that one as well. And the other one is hibiscus iced tea. The name for that in Mexico is usually Jamaica. That's like the flower of Jamaica, it's hibiscus flower. So we have those two drinks. Last year, we started doing like another breakfast item, which is called chilaquiles. We use the same chorizo and the eggs. That's mixed with tortilla chips. At the end, we put some of our tomatillo green salsa, avocado cream sauce that we make as well, and then cotija cheese. And people can put more of the toppings on that one as well. And that was very popular last year. We're gonna keep doing that this year. And we're hoping on introducing maybe another or two more like little breakfast items. I know for sure one of them we're gonna start doing like a little huevos rancheros at this Saturday market too, this year, which is like a tortilla with some refried beans, a fried egg, and some red sauce on top. And people are going to be able to put their toppings as well, like they do with the tacos or the other item, the chilaquiles.
Jesus Barajas has known that he wanted a career in food since college. After finishing culinary school in Mexico, he worked in restaurants and has been in the industry for more than 10 years. I asked him what he liked most about what he's doing now.
I love to serve people. I really enjoy watching people enjoying what we prepare. We wanted to bring that authenticity to Bloomington. And we were kind of a little bit of skeptical at the beginning when we started doing the farmers market, because we didn't know if people were gonna like what we were doing, or they were used to a different kind of tacos, right? So we were happy to find out that a lot of people, they have like the knowledge. If they travel to Mexico, or they had family there, or they live there, they do know. People tell us that they really like what we prepare, and that they miss that, or they were looking for something like that here in Bloomington. But yeah, at the beginning it was a little difficult, because we didn't know what to expect or what to do. And I am a very shy person. I am not very like outgoing and like really risky. But I just had that little voice inside. It was saying, just let's go ahead and do it. Let's go ahead and try it and see. And if it doesn't work, at least we tried it, or we try it a different way, or we try it again.
So it brings me to a question about, I was going to ask you about sourcing. Are you able to get any of your ingredients locally, or like in the summertime, are you able to get things from the farmers at the market?
Yeah, that's our main focus. And that's why we started working at the farmers market. We decided that to be our venue, right? Because we were really interested in start like sourcing our ingredients from local farmers and vendors. And we always try to highlight whatever is in season, highlight the vegetables that we use for the vegan tacos, the toppings. We have the fresh eggs that we source locally as well. A lot of the times we buy the eggs right at the market, like at 6:30, 7 a.m. in the morning, we buy our eggs for the day. Even the meats with local farmers, the pork that we use, the chorizo that we use, it's local. We made it before. And we use like local ground pork, or the chorizo that we use is always like local for a local farm. And I think that's why people appreciate the most, that we are using that product and then bringing something authentic to them as well.
So let's get into how the tacos are made. All the prep work happens ahead of time, well before the market. Sison operates out of the One World Commissary Kitchen in Bloomington.
Yeah, we work here at One World Commissary Kitchen. It's a really nice kitchen. We're able to have everything that we need to prepare for the Saturday market. We have dry storage. We have the cooler storage. And the owner and the managers here and all the people is really nice. There's a lot of vendors, local vendors, street vendors, that they work from this kitchen. And it's just like a really nice way to interact with other vendors, and like I have like a little family here. I know on Fridays they have like a get together as well at like noon in the afternoon, where they prepare lunch and everybody gets together and eats and maybe share some ideas. So yeah, I'm really, really grateful that we have this here in Bloomington, because there's a lot of great street vendors, food vendors, that sometimes it's very difficult for us, including myself, to move to an actual place. So we cut a lot of those expenses, and we are able still to bring what we love and what we like to people in the venues like the Farmers Market or the Food Truck Fridays as well.
Okay, so back to the tacos. When Jesus explained to me how they prepare the carnitas, I understood, perhaps for the first time, why people go out to eat. See, I'm the kind of person who, when I go to an arts and crafts market, I never buy anything because I think, I can just make that myself. I'm the same way with food. I taste something I like and immediately start scheming on how I can make it at home. I won't be making these tacos at home. Why would I? Sison has it down. And honestly, it's quite a process to make the carnitas. So traditionally, the pork would be deep fried in a huge amount of lard. Sison goes with the low and slow approach. They season the pork, usually a large 10-pound locally sourced pork shoulder, with salt and dry seasonings including thyme, marjoram, and black pepper. They place it in a large roasting pan along with a small amount of lard sourced also locally from the same farm that the pork comes from. They add a few bay leaves, orange juice, and a bottle of Coca-Cola. Barajas says that the Coke has a caramelizing effect on the pork, and he specifies that you want to use the kind from Mexico in a glass bottle made with sugarcane. They typically let this marinate in the fridge for most of the day. When they're ready to cook the meat, they cover it with foil and roast it overnight for 8 to 10 hours in an oven set to 225. When it's finished, they remove the pork, shred it with tongs and a fork, strain the remaining pan juices, and then add some of that back in with the pork. And that's it. The carnitas are ready to be nestled into a hot tortilla with the toppings of your choice. I can see that it's pretty straightforward, but it's not the kind of thing I would make myself. I'd rather just stop by Sison's taco stand. If you miss them at the Saturday market, they're also offering brunch on Sundays at Need More Coffee, but that's just during the winter months. And if you are the kind of person who would like to try this at home, we have the details for this recipe and the pickled red onions on our website, eartheats.org. Our website has been down this week, so if you can't find us there, check the Earth Eats Facebook page. And you can always find us on Twitter, at Earth Eats. Production support comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers on Bloomington's east side corner of Pete Ellis and Longview. Brunch every Sunday from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. NeedMoreRoasters.com. Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. A big thank you to everyone who makes Earth Eats possible. That includes Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killow, Daniel Orr, Farm Bloomington Restaurant, Indiana University Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Jesus Barajas and Sison Mexican Cuisine. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm Kate Young. Thanks for listening to Earth Eats. We'll see you next week.